Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. This episode, we have my friend James Hinchcliffe, the mayor of Hinchtown, one of IndyCar's brightest stars, also one of the brightest personalities, I think, in motor racing in general. This lovely Toronto area bred Canadian has really stood out as someone who ties every aspect of the sport together. Wicked talent inside a race car, tons and tons of personality outside of it. Immensely talented in the broadcast booth, and as we recently learned, he's not bad when it comes time to dance. So great for him to shine on the, I guess, more public stage, the wider stage outside the world of IndyCar racing and sports in general. Known Hinch for a while, and I figured it was time for us to sit down and do a podcast to learn about him and really understand what makes him tick, his upbringing, what it was like in the Hinchcliffe house. A lot of nuggets in here, and that was probably the most enjoyable aspect of the sit-down with the mayor. That personality of his was really, really fascinating to get a grasp on where it came from, how it developed, why it had to. Went into his start in the sport, his schooling. Really interesting to find out about what some of his teachers and what some testing revealed about that brain of his that has helped him with what he does today. Went through his, I guess, slow ascension towards the big leagues in motor racing. He's someone who, I don't want to call a lifer, but it did feel like he was destined for a life on the, what we would call today, the Mazda Road to Indy, that junior open wheel training series ladder. Got into his first season of IndyCar racing, how that came about. A bit harrowing, really interesting too, the contract, not a written one, but just a verbal contract with his parents on his career through that road to Indy process, and whether he would make it to IndyCar or not, and what would happen there. Finding out about how that first season in IndyCar kicked off. And with this recording, we had about 45 minutes or so. Was hoping to have a little bit more, so we ended up deciding to cut essentially at the end of the 2011 season, his first IndyCar season. So we will be doing a part two here very shortly to get into more of his IndyCar career, his Dancing with the Stars fun, having fellow IndyCar driver Connor Daly is not only someone who lives with him, but he's effectively raising a young IndyCar driver. It feels like being a parent to a young IndyCar driver. But we stopped at the end of 2011, getting into 2012 with some, it's pretty serious. It was really interesting to hear Hinch's thoughts and what he recalls from his emotions and dealing with, everyone dealing with, losing Dan Weldon at the Las Vegas season finale, knowing that Dan was destined to drive for Andretti Autosport the following season to take over Danica Patrick's seat in the GoDaddy IndyCar. And with Danny Boy dying, unfortunately, James getting that opportunity. It's just fascinating to hear Hinch, also to hear his humanity and how he dealt with that as a young guy. First year in IndyCar, big door opens, but through very unfortunate circumstances, and how he had to, or how he chose to tread his way through that, and how far he's come since then. So that's where we cut off, knowing that we have a lot more to pick up once we get into that 2012 season. The cool sports car stuff he does with Mazda, just everything about the world of Hinch that we're going to get into, his own podcast. So these are all things coming up in part two, but although we had a couple of laughs in here as we normally do, it's more of a straightforward get to know James Hinchcliffe, and I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did sitting there just listening to the mayor talk, because this is someone who I think many of us feel like we know very well, but I know that I came away after this feeling like I actually really knew the person that brings a lot of joy and happiness to folks in this sport. So off we go with the mayor.
Before we get into the jokey, haha, funny stuff of you being an IndyCar driver and slumlord and parent to an IndyCar driver,
yeah,
tell me about growing up in the lovely country of Canada, one of my favorite places. I call the Greater Toronto Area clean San Francisco. And what the general Hinchcliffe household was like coming up, because I'm a big believer that some people can have their world shaped early and they go and live that life, and others find the life they want on their own. how does James today link back to the kid growing up as a boy?
Yeah, I mean, a lot, in a lot of ways. You know, my
parents are the best. You know, as far as the parental lottery goes, I did pretty well. You know, you don't get to pick them. And, you know, I'm a big believer in, you know, how your kids are raised or how they turn out. And I'm not saying I turned out that well, but it could have been worse, I think. You know, growing up in Canada was great, man. I love it there. You know, that's home. That will always be home. We grew up in a little suburb in a town called Markham outside the east side of Toronto. And, you know, my upbringing was fairly typical, atypical for Canadian in the sense that my dad didn't like hockey. You know, my dad was English and his passion was motorsports. So from a young age, I was really subjected to that and I really took to it. I've got an older brother and an older sister. Neither one of them kind of caught the racing bug. So, you know, dad tried for a third one and struck gold on that one. But, you know, my dad worked very hard. He owned his own business and he was gone a lot.
What did he do?
He owned a company that they would buy bulk gas and oils off of the majors, off of your Sunocos and your Petro-Canadas and Essos and sell it to the, you know, the mom and pop shops that own one or two gas stations in rural Ontario.
So you're not 5 years old with a garden hose siphoning out of cars. We're talking volume here.
Right, exactly. Okay, exactly. So, but you know, that he started the business himself in 86 and with a partner from the US, but it was just him was the Canadian branch and he grew it to a, you know, a company of 100 people. And that takes a lot of time, you know, it takes a lot of work. And as a young kid, I saw that working hard, you know, equaled good results. Effort equals results, as Roger Penske likes to say. And
never heard of him.
You should Google him. Fascinating guy.
Was your dad the kind who was telling you effort equals results, or is that an observed thing?
No, it was an observation. You know, he definitely instilled a lot of good traits. He had a lot of good, you know, kind of cheesy taglines that stuck with me over the years. But
let's hear a couple. Come on now.
Well, like one of the big ones is
underwear first, then pants.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Underwear first, then pants. Build your pyramid from the bottom up. You know, a lot of people, they want to be at the top right away, but that's the most precarious part of it. You know, you gotta build a good solid foundation before you get to where you want to go.
Your father was trying to make sure he didn't have a millennial. I like that.
Right. Know what you don't know. You know, my dad was successful in business because he'll be the first to tell you that he did not know everything about the business he was in. So he surrounded himself with the people that knew the things that he did not.
Smart.
And, you know, things like that were... you know, philosophies instilled in me at a very young age, and I didn't really appreciate what they meant too much at the time and how valuable they were going to be to me later in life.
Well, that's some big picture stuff that you're getting fairly early on. It's, whether it was fully registering or not, that's not a lot. I should say not a lot. I don't see as many parents attempting to open up the world for their kids early. It's often a bit of a retroactive thing. Hey, so when you do get off the couch, realize that you can do more in life.
Right, right. And so because of that, because of, you know, he was working hard and we saw that, and I was really at a young age, obviously my mom was a bigger influence because I was spending a lot of time with her. She really raised the kids, and you know, she was an incredible mother. She had a career of her own that she gave up once when she had my sister, and you know, stayed out of the workplace until I was old enough to go to, you know, elementary school full time, and then she kind of went back to work a little bit. But she was a great mom, and you know, one of the big things for us was family dinners. And it's funny because we'd have friends come over, and they would be like, "Man, you guys do things differently over here." Because at the Hinchcliffe household, every day, all five of us would get together and have a big family dinner. And it wasn't like, hey, dinner's on the stove, feed yourself, or someone's eating sometimes, someone's eating at another time. And, you know, I think sitting there, and we'd hear about Dad's day, you know, we'd hear about what was happening at work. And so I think some of the business side, you know, kind of just naturally seeped in there. And then, you know, obviously just getting to have conversation with adults at a young age. Something that my parents were really big on was, They made a really conscious effort to not change their lifestyle around having kids. They incorporated their kids into their lifestyle.
Brilliant.
And so they would have friends over for, you know, dinner, and it was great. When we were young, they'd have friends over for dinner, and they'd show up, They'd sit around and have a cocktail, and the three kids would sit there with them, and we'd talk, and they'd ask us questions, and we'd learn who these people were, and then we'd get $20 to order pizza and go upstairs and eat ourselves, and the adults would go have dinner. But that interaction with grown-ups for the first hour they were there, in hindsight, I look back on it, and I look at people I know with kids or, you know, whatever. I can't tell you how valuable that was in hindsight, you know, just having that ability to converse with somebody five times my age at the time, you know. I think it served us all, you know, my brother, sister, and I very well.
Well, it's funny. We're very similar in the same thing. Five in our family, dinner every night, same kind of thing, and it was not optional. Mm-hmm. And same thing with the parties. My parents loved to entertain. It wasn't upstairs, it was downstairs. But yeah, we would hang out upstairs, and they never actually said, all right, it's time to go downstairs. There was just kind of a point where I was helping, we would be helping a few too many. Sometimes my father to stand up straight,
right,
or to walk. I was like, all right, we're going to kind of leave this to the adults here because they're falling down drunk. So tell me about school. Were you a kid that liked your edumacation? Were you someone whose mind was off thinking of bigger and better things, daydreaming? What kind of student was James Hinchcliffe?
I was a little bit of a daydreamer. There were, you know, my young schooling, you know, first couple years, I struggled a little bit, to be honest. I remember one day in particular trying to learn math, trying to learn addition, and having zero concept of addition, and just like seeing, you know, 4 + 7, and I was literally just writing numbers down as the answers. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But then it all kind of came good. At some point, I came home. I came home from school one day, and my sister used to take piano lessons. And so my mama picked me up from school, and we'd go drop my sister off for a piano lesson, and we'd go sit at a little coffee shop and have, you know, an orange juice and a fruit punch and a donut for an hour while Becca learned piano.
What's a favorite donut for you?
Maple dip. Come on.
Okay.
I'm Canadian.
Okay.
So we sat in Pete's Donuts, and and this was our Monday afternoon routine as Becca did her piano lessons. And one day I was going through my backpack to get out some homework, and I found this envelope, and I thought, oh no, I was supposed to give this to mom like 2 weeks ago. So I'm like, hey mom, I got this at school. They told me to give it to you. Didn't tell her when it was from. And she opened up the letter and she read it, and she looked at me and she goes, where'd you get this? So I thought was a very peculiar question at the time. I got it from my teacher. Why? She's like, I don't know. I think there's been a mistake. I'm like, what? Like, can you be a little bit more specific? I was in grade 3. And she said, well, this is saying that you're gifted. So in Ontario.
Gifted how?
Gifted intellectually.
Okay. Not we're giving them a football helmet and then cowboy boots
and a padded room.
Yeah.
So in Ontario in grade 3, there's provincial-wide testing to identify kids that are gifted. And so I had been identified gifted. And so I had to go in for some additional testing, and everything was confirmed. I didn't cheat on the test, which was what my mom was thinking may have happened. And so for grade 4, I switched schools. And I switched into a gifted program.
Wow.
And then in the summer between grade 4 and 5, we actually moved. So I had to move to a different town, different school, obviously, and in the different region we were going to, they had slightly different rules to identify as gifted. So I had to retake this test. I had to sit with this doctor lady for like 5 hours and go through all this stuff. And I got accepted as gifted in this school region. So I had to go to the gifted school there. I did that for 5, 6, 7. And then the program was moving to a different school for what would have been grade 8 for me. And my mom felt so bad that I had been moved around so many times in school that she was like, look, it's up to you. You can either drop out of the program and just go to our local elementary school for your last year before you go to high school. Or if you want, you can go to this other school, which was like a bit of a drive away and was going to be a bit of a thing. But a lot of my friends from that school were going to be going there. So I decided to actually leave the program and go to my local elementary school so I would start meeting some of the kids that I was going to be going to high school with. Because most of the kids in the gifted program with me, we were all going to different schools because we were all coming from far away. And so I didn't want to show up to high school as the complete new kid, knowing nobody.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, high school is terrifying enough as it is.
Good old gifty gift over here.
Exactly right. Yeah. So I went to 4 different elementary schools. And I think that, you know, being the new kid and being forced to kind of, you know, ingratiate myself into different groups kind of molded me a little bit in the sense. So I think a lot of my sense of humor came out of that.
Well, you either go completely inward and you're the kid, the sad kid at the far end of the lunch hall eating by himself, or you realize that social graces actually matter in life and you kind of open yourself up. Mm-hmm. Wow. What, in terms of gifted, I mean, I guess there are many forms. Was there a specific area where testing said you were gifted, or was it just, he's special in every way?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of like the problem-solving kind of area of stuff. I love puzzles. I really, really enjoy puzzles, word games, things like that. And yeah, so there's a bunch of different areas that they test in, and I don't remember my specific marks in any of them, but... It was interesting. I mean, I don't think the gifted program was that different from the regular program. I think they taught you in a little bit of a different way. Maybe you had a little bit more freedom, and I'm not quite sure, but...
What was your recognition to that, the being told that you have, I don't know if gift, just keep using the word gift, but not that you're different, but you have something maybe a little extra. Did it sink in any way, or was it just like, oh, okay, well, I'll try it. You say I'm this. Let me see what it's like.
Yeah, I mean, at that age, it's tough to really, you know, process what that means. You know, I still don't even entirely get what it really means, to be honest. But I saw it as an opportunity. Really, I remember thinking that, you know, if this will make me not smart at the time. You say smarter because you know you're a kid. You don't think of it any other way.
I can tie both of my shoes.
If this prepares me better for something in the future, this is a cool opportunity. Yeah. You know,
where does this start to transition into love of sport, athleticism? I think most kids do something athletic. Where does this part of your world start to enter in terms of my brain's doing pretty good. They're feeding it some good stuff. I'm getting to meet a lot of people. I'm enjoying this part of my life. Where does playing sports turn into, is there something here for me to follow, maybe in the 3, 4, or 5, however many wheel world? Where does that thought process start to happen in your world?
Well, it's funny because I never played sports. I was never... an athletic kid in that sense, you know, like I did tennis for a little bit, and I think I did a year of soccer like most kids in Canada. Never played hockey, which is weird. And I didn't really have a desire for any of them. The only thing that interested me on the sporting front was racing. And I was a fan of the sport long before I ever sat in anything with an engine. I just loved watching it. I loved watching it with Dad. I loved going to the race in Toronto, you know. And it really wasn't until the day that I discovered that go-kart racing was a thing that I had even contemplated the thought of doing something like that.
Now, had you done any, like, little fun putt-putt carts locally?
Yeah, for sure. Did some of that stuff. And, like, my dad had an inkling early because, you know, when you're yay big, you have to have the adult in the back seat kind of thing, right? And you get to sit in front and drive. And he tells a story. I think I was 6 years old or something like that. And so I'm running around with him in the back seat and, like, never lifting off the throttle. Thing would get sideways, and I would just correct, like, naturally. He never had to teach me how to do that, never had an issue with that kind of stuff. And so he kind of saw it coming, I think, way before I did, because, again, I didn't know that this world existed. But then he started vintage racing at the age of 45.
What was he driving?
He started with a TR4, Triumph TR4.
Nice.
Yeah, he had a Death Wish. And
I restored a TR3. I know the Death Wishness.
Yeah, he went from a TR4 to a TVR Vixen.
So your dad really wants to meet the Grim Reaper?
Yep. And then, that thing was pretty interesting. And then he got wise and got into a vintage Formula Ford. But his first year of racing vintage cars, we met a guy that had a kid who was racing a Bug Eye Sprite, and his kid raced go-karts. So he's like, come check out my son's go-kart race. I'm like, what do you mean go-kart race? And so he went and checked it out. And I was like, yeah. Yep.
Me?
Yes. Yes. One of those.
Wow. I love it.
Yeah.
So you get in, and those innate skills of learning to counter steer and all those things, do those things manifest quickly? Do you run into a lot of things?
I was rubbish.
Okay.
I finished last every single race my first season. But I like puzzles. I like challenges. And so...
And those who maybe don't know, racing is cars and colors and sounds and speed and all kinds of stuff and trophies and champagne. At its absolute core, if you were to boil motor racing down, the final element that would be left is problem solving.
Problem solving. And so I was relishing the challenge. You know, I was hating finishing last. So evidently I also have a bit of a competitive streak.
What?
Who knew? And so the combination of being competitive and enjoying problem solving, I was like, okay, I got to figure out how to do this. And I remember, I'll never forget, it was like halfway through my first season of go-kart, and I had finished last again, and we were driving home, and Dad looked over at me, and he was like, you know, if this isn't fun anymore, we can stop. Like, give it a try, and if it's not your thing, it's totally cool. And I was like, no, I love this. Like, I'm going to figure this out.
Was your dad equally as competitive or more? Or was that?
No, my dad was the anti-karting dad.
Wow.
He was the best possible racing dad you could ever have. You know, the day that, so him, you know, him and I did everything until I was about 14 and I started racing shifter carts, and I started doing like the pro tour around North America or whatever. And all of a sudden the running a shifter cart, running at that level, Dad was like, I know what I don't know. I know I don't know how to make this go fast enough for you. So I'm gonna step back, a mechanic stepped in. And the day that he put the wrenches down, he put down the stopwatch, and he was never that. I never saw him at the fence with a stopwatch.
Wow.
He would sit there and watch, and he would give his input, but he was like, those guys know what they're doing. You know what you're doing. I'm just here to watch. And he never put any pressure on me. He was never the kicking, yelling, screaming, you idiot, how'd you do that? Why are you 2 tenths off? Like, you got to do that. He just let the people who knew what they were doing do their thing.
Your father could make money teaching some other racing fathers how to behave.
He's a goddamn pioneer. He's a Renaissance man. Old Jeremy Hinchcliffe. Jer Bear? The Stash?
That'd be a great business card right there.
Yeah. No, he was the best. He was honestly the best. And everybody loved working with him. Like, every team I drove for, from go-karts through Schmidt-Peterson Motorsports, were like, God, your dad's the best. You know?
He's always telling me to quit. That's what I got. You know? No, Dad, that's the wrong kind of motivation. So, karts. Do you like the solo aspect of that? Because, again, I know you said you weren't, you know, super into team sports as a kid, but if you're playing soccer, you're in a team environment. You know, I know racing, there's a team environment as well, but there's a certain point where you pull away from pit lane, and it is just you. There can be pressure from that if you allow yourself to feel that pressure, and there can also be none. I kind of call it the Scott Dixon syndrome, where just the world washes away, and you're this brilliant solo performer. What was going on in your head at that time? Because I think that would probably map where you would go in this sport in the future.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I never had an aversion to team sports. It's not that I didn't play well with others or anything, to the concept of them. It's just those particular sports didn't interest me, you know? And the more I think about it, karting really is kind of more of an individual sport, certainly at the starting level. You know, it was me and Dad, and that was it. You know, there are times where I watch other, you know, professional, you know, stick and ball sports, for lack of a better term, and I'm envious kind of the kind of teammate feeling and the camaraderie and the rest of it. I mean, racing is in my view genuinely like the epitome of team sport, because the whole team is required to make sure that everybody is safe and gets to go home that night, and no other sport is quite like that. But at the end of the day, when you're out on the track battling, it is just you on track. And so you can come in and you can, you know, high-five all your crew guys for the great stops and the engineers for the great car and all the rest of it, but they weren't out there with you. They're in it with you, which is its own thing. But it's not like, you know, throwing the winning touchdown pass to your wide receiver or whatever. Like, that connection is a bit different. And I admire that in other sports, and I you know, I think that's really cool. But it was never like a feeling of needing to be more in a sport where I could kind of just do my thing and it was all on me. I just liked driving, and that's just happened to be how driving is.
Where does the karting experience and education start to evolve into the proverbial fork in the road? either say, hey, this was cool and fun, and I'll tell stories once when I'm in college to my pals there, and when I get my 9-to-5 selling real estate or whatever it is, or forget the 9-to-5 and forget that career. I maybe need to see if I can make this a thing, because I think there could be talent to do that. What was that recognition? And when did that happen?
I think that fork in the road.
Or has it happened?
I was still trying to decide if I should be in a 9-to-5 instead. It might have.
I'm James. Can I sell you home insurance?
More longevity. Go get my CPA. I never got into karting with aspirations of driving for a living. Hmm. I, at 9 years old, when I started, knew that that wasn't a real job and that people didn't actually get to do that. You know, that was a fantasy. It was a fairy tale. It wasn't until I was 14 and I was approached by a karting team that ran the Pro Tour and full of kids that wanted to be professional racing drivers came up to me and they're like, hey, we would like you to drive on our team. And I thought, well, that's weird. I never really thought about doing that. And so, you know, Dad and I agreed and we did it. And all of a sudden I was now competing with guys that had from the age of 5 dedicated every minute of their lives to wanting to be a professional driver. Mm. And you're competing with these guys, you know? And so all of a sudden that's when kind of the switch flipped in my head. It's like, okay.
Was that an immediate flip or did it take to,
no,
did it, you have to
it,
get immersed?
It took a season.
Okay.
It took a season. You know, and by the end of the season you could compete with these guys, you could race these guys, you're passing these guys, you're beating these guys, and it's like, all right, maybe this is a thing. And then the real fire got lit when I was 15. I got special permission to do a race at the Bridgestone Racing Academy up at Mosport, and you're supposed to be 16, but I got some special dispensation, and it was my first time in a race car. And you know, it's a controlled environment, school cars, the whole deal, very Skip Barber-esque. And you're racing against guys that were 18, 19, 20, 21 that had aspirations to be professional racing drivers. And it was a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday kind of deal, and there was three races. There was a race on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and by Sunday I won the race. So at 15 I'd won a race in a car, my first time in a car, you know, whatever, against guys that had been doing this for some time and had goals of doing this for a living
in a recognized series structure,
right?
You know, this meant something.
And so, you know, this is the same school that Greg Moore had been through, that Jacques Villeneuve had been through. And so when the owner of the school, you know, makes comments like he did, and I sit there and accept the fact that my mom had to drive me to the track today because I don't have a license, yet I could win against these guys. That was really the day that I kind of thought, wow, this might actually be something we can do.
Wow. How old are you, son? I'm this many. Wow. So you go from that first taste, and from what I know...
That first taste of sparkling apple juice.
Yes, exactly. Didn't spray as well as I thought on the podium. So that's a pretty cool moment. Did that moment register with you, that you had achieved something pretty cool if we're looking at that map of going to bigger things?
Yeah, definitely. That was one of the big turning points, you know, internally. But then also externally, you know, because of, like I said, the guy that owns the school, Brett Goodman, has seen 1,000 guys go through that school and noticed something. And it was the first time I got an article in a newspaper,
hey.
You know, hey, local kid done good at the racetrack. So, you know, that was really for me a really big moment in like the map of my career.
So racing isn't cheap. Had others say and written before,
it's only money.
It's not like you buy a pair of sneakers and a tennis racket and you're now effectively capable of playing Wimbledon or wherever else. Does the Hinchcliffe parental units, do they start wondering, oh Jesus, this kid's doing good at something that's not cheap, how do we make this happen? How do you go from level to level without the parents moving you guys into a tent out in the woods? How do you make that happen? Because that's one area that probably trips up more. There are probably more Ayrton Senna level champions we've never heard of, never known of, because the cost barrier at the formative stages of being good, but mm-hmm. now I need to go to the big leagues.
Yeah, I mean, racing is one of the stupidest sports because of that, but it's Dad's fault. He got me in it, so I don't feel bad for him at all.
Okay, good.
You know, it's funny. We had a really, really kind of roller coaster experience on the like sponsor and financial side of coming through the ranks of racing. You know, my first full year, you know, my parents, they did pretty well, and so we could afford karting. You know, Dad could afford to send me through the SCUSA tour.
Yeah.
And, you know, do the British Home Racing Academy and things like that. But once you kind of get into your own car and your own team and, you know, proper formula car racing, it gets a little more complicated. And my first season of proper racing was in Formula BMW. And I had gone to this shootout for BMW in Spain and won one of the scholarships. So we got a bit of money from BMW to go race. And then we actually found a guy, a sponsor, to buy the car for the team.
Nice.
So like our first year racing wasn't that bad. You know, we had some support. We had the car bought, you know, whatever.
Now, are you writing sponsorship proposals and such, or you have parents helping, or?
Yeah. So at this point is when Dad and I started kind of doing it. You know, I remember sitting in front of my first CEO of a, you know, multi-million dollar company at 17 years old.
Wow.
And trying to sell him on the dream, you know. Didn't work.
That'd
with that one
good
in particular.
James the dream.
But you know, we got through that year, and then the next year we didn't have as much help, and it was really tough to kind of put it together, and we kind of ran on a bit of a shoestring budget compared to other teams, and you know, kind of made it work. And then the next year we had a full sponsorship for my first season of Atlantic, you know, everything paid for. And then the next season, only a little bit of sponsorship. And so you're begging, borrowing, and stealing. And, you know, at that level, as everybody knows, it's so tough to actually get sponsorship.
Yep.
You know, I was lucky that year the team owner was, you know, able to help. And then we borrowed from some friends and whatever. And we kind of did this cyclical roller coaster. It seemed like a good season sponsorship wise, and then a really bad one, and then a good one, and then a bad one. And I did all the things that a lot of guys do. I sold myself. You know, I sold a percentage of future earnings. I took out loans. I did all the things that we had to do.
Some of the high risk and or uncomfortable stuff.
For sure. And like you know. In a lot of cases, the first people you go to are friends, right?
Yeah.
So that's a big risk too, is if things go pear-shaped.
Yeah. If this doesn't work, A, I'm going to have no friends, and B, I will be selling myself, but
right.
In a different manner,
in a very
on the
different
streets.
Fashion. If you have to ask, you can't afford it. So it was a challenge, you know. And we came across some good people throughout the years that really helped with educating us on how to go about finding sponsorship and things like that, and trying to come up with different strategies on how to do it. And there's no doubt it's the toughest part, but it's also one of the best life experiences, because you learn so much from a business point of view about what companies look for, what a certain company in a certain industry would benefit from over another one.
Yeah.
And even to this day, you know, I'm so fortunate to be in the position that I'm in. I'm with a team. I make a salary and all the rest of it. But you're still always looking for more for the team, personally, you know, whatever it is. And that business education that you get is so valuable. And then you're able to parlay that into things away from racing, and you know, try and get involved in some business stuff away from the track.
Smart man. So I love your junior open wheel career, probably from a more personal sense, because it mirrors mine.
Because it lasted so long, and I got to take a bunch of pictures of you.
Brother, I started as a gopher with a Super V team in 86. Worked through as a mechanic, mostly a mechanic, but a little bit of engineering stuff later. But Super V, Atlantic, and Indy Lights. It took till 97. From 86 to 97 was the first year I graduated to IndyCar.
Right.
Earlier you said there's really no such thing as a professional career go-karter. You damn near made a professional career out of being on what we would call today the Mazda Road to Indy.
Yeah.
Five different teams. I know you came back to one, but five different teams in 5 years across Atlantic and Lights. What was that experience like for you? I think we could assume 5 years would be feeling like, Jesus, am I stuck? Or am I not? What's going through your head as you're getting into year three, year four? Are you seeing roadblocks? Are you seeing, maybe this isn't going to happen?
I mean, I saw that roadblock so many times. I saw that dead end sign so many times in my career. And, you know, it's funny, the always switching teams thing, I didn't realize at the time, I think actually, again, served me really well because it gave me a lot of experience working with different engineers, different cultures within race teams, things like that. When I looked at, not in a bad way, because I'm not going to say this in a bad way at all, but, you know, the career of, say, Zach Veach, right, where he started with Andretti at the 2-liter level and then the Mazda level, and then if you kept going with Andretti to the lights level and then into an, if you only ever raced from like the age of 16 until 22 and you managed to climb the whole ladder with one team, the culture of that team, the people in that team, all the rest of it, if then one day you have to switch, like let's say you get to IndyCar, you do 2 years with Andretti and then you got to switch to a different team, the culture shock massive to someone who started so young in one organization would just be enormous. And so I got the opportunity, inadvertently and accidentally and involuntarily, to experience a lot of different things, work with a lot of different people through my junior Formula Car career, and I think that that actually served me really well.
I think we called you, hi, my name is James, because that was just the phrase. Yeah, meet so many people.
I had to say it so many times. But, I mean, as far as the roadblock thing, man, like, there were a bunch, I mean, first of all, you know, the 08 happened, which ended a lot of guys' careers, and very nearly ended mine.
The split coming together finally with Champ Car and IndyCar merging, but with two distinct ladder systems and one that really only survived.
On top of the fact that the world fell apart.
Yep.
And so frivolous expenditures like motorsport were the first things to go from every company's, you know, bottom line. So money dried up, and I was on the wrong side, quote-unquote, of the merge, so to speak. And that was a year where we weren't sure we were going to be able to bounce back from it. And then didn't have a very good first year in lights, to be honest. And the second year was going well. And it's funny. So I actually went to university for a brief period. I did a year and a half at school.
Anything trying to specialize in or pique your interest there?
Ironically, I actually wanted to go into journalism.
I was hoping you could say math. That would have impressed me.
Right. So I didn't. I ended up going into commerce and economics. I figured I should learn how the business works. So, because if I don't have the money, I don't get to go racing. So an engineering degree would be great, but it's going to mean nothing if I'm not in a car.
And we're going to touch on driver economics and future planning in a little bit.
Perfect. So I went to school for a little bit, and then when I got the fully sponsored ride to move up to Atlantic with Forsythe, a Champ Car team that's got a rich history with Canadian drivers, I kind of sat down with my parents because, you know, education was super important to them. Going to school was not my idea. I'll be the first to admit that. But my parents really pushed education all through high school. If I didn't maintain an 80 average, racing stopped. You know, same kind of thing, university.
I like that.
You want to motivate a kid to do his homework.
Yeah, yeah.
Kept me out of trouble, kept me focused on school. It was great. It was brilliant. It was actually an idea they got from Brian Herta. My dad met Brian Herta at the Toronto Indy in, I don't know, 90-something. And asked him that question because I just started racing. And he said, my parents said I had to maintain a 70 average to keep racing. Dad's like, I like that. It's going to be 80, though. Damn it. Thank God Brian didn't say 80 or else it would have been 90. So anyway, I went to school and then I got this opportunity. And I sat them down and I said, look, guys, this is a once-in-a-lifetime thing. Like, if I'm going to take this seriously, I've got to dedicate all my time and focus to this. And they reluctantly agreed. So they said, but you got to go to your school and see what kind of deal you can work out. So I go to my school and I said, here's the deal. What can we do? They said, cool, we'll give you a 5-year deferral. Come back anytime in the next 5 years and you pick up right where you left off, no problems. And I thought, great. So I go back to mom and dad all excited and tell them, they're like, cool, you have 5 years to make a living driving race cars. I went, that's not the response I was expecting, but challenge accepted. And so fast forward 4 years and 9 months, I've tested with Newman Haas, who had signed Oriole, and we're looking for a young guy to partner him. I went down to a 2-day test at Sebring, and at the end of that 2 days, I was a 10th quicker than Oriole. And they're like, yep, James, we love you, we want to sign you. And I walked away from that test thinking, this is it, like, that was it.
Getting ready for St. Pete.
Right, like, that. I knew that 2010 was probably gonna be my last year of being able to drive in a junior formula career. You know, I had finished, I nearly won the championship, I finished second, won a bunch of races, proved myself on ovals, road courses, street courses. went to this test, nailed the test, like job interview basically, couldn't have gone better. Neumann Haas, with all their history, were like, yeah.
Mom and dad, I'm going to the top.
Right. I'm like, we're done. This is it. We're there. They're like, James, we love you. Want to sign you. One problem. Don't have any money. And I was like, it's okay.
Me too.
Yeah. It's another thing we have in common. But I was like, no, it's cool because you're Neumann Haas. You're going to find money. You're Neumann Haas. It's fine. Like, I'm not even worried about it. This is in December. So we had a drop-dead date that we had to get money in the bank in order to make a car ready in time for St. Pete. And really long story short, a lot of trying on both our ends. It's not like we sat back and watched them try. My dad and I were up here in Canada trying to make something happen, meeting people, doing meetings, throwing out proposals left, right, and center. And that drop-dead day came and went. And we had to swallow the fact that I was not going to be racing at St. Pete. And that was a really tough moment, you know, because the way I looked at it, I was like, there's nothing else that I can, it's out of my control, you know, as a driver, as someone trying to help find sponsorship, whatever. I've literally done everything in my control to get there, and it didn't work out. And I sat there and thought, maybe it just wasn't meant to be. Maybe the universe is telling me, hey, you gave it a good run and you had some fun, but, you know, you're 24 now, let's get back to the real world.
Go buy a new backpack, get some pencils.
Sharpen those pencils, sharpen that HB2, and let's go. And so, because the fact of the matter is, that was March 2011, and September 2011 would have been the end of my 5 years.
Yeah.
And I was in St. Pete with the team, had my Neumann Haas polo on, standing on the pit stand, watching everyone else drive around and thinking, all right, and I accepted it almost. I was like, okay, you know, I guess this is it. I'll enjoy the summer. Yeah. I'll travel around with the team and have one last hurrah, and then September I'll be back in school.
Wow.
And then the Saturday night of St. Pete, one of the sponsors called us back and said, yeah, we're in. When can we get a car ready? And 2 weeks later, I made my IndyCar debut with Barber.
Lovely silver machine.
Mm-hmm.
That was really cool. I know the general sensation at the time was this kid has put in his time. If we're talking about dues being paid, 5 years in the junior open wheel formula, almost getting that title at the end, and as you mentioned, you'd also shown that ovals, which is, it's a funny thing for IndyCar team owners.
Mm-hmm.
Quick road racers, spin the globe, you'll find them every continent. Quick road racers who can also pick up on ovals, there's something a little different there. So money aside, budget aside, the fact that you'd shown well in ovals, I think had to be one of the things that impressed Neumann Haas. So you have this opportunity come in, and within a very short amount of time, you're going to be making your Indy 500 debut. You're going to be full-bore IndyCar driver. Is there an adjustment period mentally? Not as if you weren't going to autograph sessions and Indy Lights and whatnot and didn't have media requests, but it's a whole different world. Whatever you were used to at the road to Indy level, that just starts raging once you get thrown into IndyCar. Plus, you have to drive.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, you have to perform. Did that screw your head at all? Or had you been through enough already to where it's just more of a accepted adaptation?
Yeah, I think because it took me so long, quote unquote, to get there, I was a little older. I was a little more mature. I understood the situation and the landscape, I think, a bit better than like a 19-year-old kid that gets tossed into it. So I think that was good. I think that prepared me pretty well in that sense. And the other part of it is, not necessarily the best thing, but the silver lining in Neumann Haas not having a bunch of sponsorship and not having a bunch of partners and all the rest of it is I got thrown into the higher level of competition and the higher level of, you know, demand on you as a driver on track. And the off-track stuff was kind of more of it was a smaller step, you know, because we didn't have a ton of partners. Nobody knew who I was, so it's not like I was in demand from media or whatever. The off-track side was a much smaller gain, so it gave me more energy and more time and more brain power to focus on the big jump, which was on track. When I switched to Andretti in 2012, that off-track gain was as big as my 2010 to 2011 on-track jump. Wow. And so if I had to do both of the, if I'd gone straight to an Andretti, for example, and had that level of, you know, commercial backing and had to deal with that kind of, you know, off-track stuff, that would have been overwhelming. So the fact that, Newman Haas, you know, on track was a powerhouse, but off track, you know, commercially we were struggling, almost was kind of good for me in a sense.
I'll ask this a few more times before we're done, but what did you learn about yourself in that rookie season of IndyCar with Newman Haas? We saw the results you had. You were finished fourth in your second IndyCar race. You had a lot of really good finishes. But what did you learn about yourself? Because now all of a sudden you're seeing a Castro Neves, a Dixon, a Kanaan, big names. You're out there. You're showing folks that, guess what? I can hang. This is where I belong. Did you feel that?
You know, it's funny. It wasn't until... So Long Beach was my second race. And we go to our first race at Barber, and I qualified eighth. You know, I was next to Dario.
Who?
Exactly. I was like less than a tenth out of making the Firestone Fast Six in my first IndyCar race. I was starting next to a million time champion. And
great hair too.
I mean, beautiful, gorgeous locks. And I didn't think about it at that point. You know, it was still, everything was still like, you know, when they said everybody clear the grid before the start of the race, I nearly walked off. You know, because I'd been on the grid of every race the year before as a lights driver, and at that point, that's when I was exit stage left for James.
The best.
And you know, that moment, you know, I should have been like, yeah, I qualified eighth my first race, whatever. But you know, it was one race. It could have been a fluke, and you know, I don't know. And then we go to Long Beach, and I'm walking back from practice, from the pits to the paddock, and I run into Dario. And we're kind of chatting. He's just, how you know, Dario was, he was so good to me.
Mm-hmm.
Through lights and, you know, first couple of years in IndyCar, he's just a huge supporter and just a huge mentor for me. And I was telling him, but it's just kind of things. I'm like, I can't believe I'm here. I can't believe this, whatever. And he puts his arm around me and he goes, Hinchy, my boy, let me tell you something. He goes, you spend your whole lifetime watching this level and trying to get here. And then you get here and you realize you're racing against the same 10 jackasses you have been your whole career. And like something about him saying that just like made it click to me. He goes, they're all just people. Yeah. He goes, it's not Scott Dixon, Target, Chip Ganassi, multi-champion, Indy 500 winner. That's just some guy from New Zealand. You know, he did the same thing you did to get here.
And he's a ginger, you know.
Which, I don't even want to talk about that. No, oh no, he won the Indy 500. He became a strawberry blonde.
Okay, fair enough.
That's how that works, apparently.
Fair enough.
So when I stopped looking at these people like who they were,
yeah.
And started looking at them as who they really were,
brilliant.
It just made such a difference. And I'm like, yeah, I can do this. I deserve to be here, you know. And I think that helped me a lot. The confidence in myself, and then we went out and finished fourth in that race. You know, so something about that comment that he gave me just really made me more comfortable and made me believe that, you know, I belonged there.
Before we get into wearing the lovely green GoDaddy colors, tell me about working with my favorite R rolling race car driver, Oriol Servia. Love, just one of the most lovely human beings. What was he like as a teammate?
He couldn't have been better. I mean, I lucked out, man. That whole first year was so great in so many levels, you know, to have a team as experienced and successful as Newman Haas, right? But like I said, to not kind of have some of the pressure that maybe a team with a bunch more sponsorship and commercial partners would have had, to have a teammate like Oriol, who is so experienced, he's so technically savvy. He's one of the few guys that went to school. He had so much advice, you know, and was so open to sharing it with me. I got to work with Craig Hampson.
Yeah, yeah.
My rookie season. Are you high? Are you kidding me?
You go from Hampson to a squirrel. That's not a bad career trajectory.
Hampshire to a squirrel. It's, you know, and so, and Oriol was such a big part of that, man. I mean, every single one of my, like, big first experiences I shared with him in IndyCar. And so it was, I was just so fortunate in that sense. And, you know, he remains a good friend to this day. And, I'm stoked that he's got his deal for the 500 sorted, and hopefully it ends up being more. But he, technically, I learned a lot from him. I learned a lot about how to set up a car, why you set up a car a certain way at a certain track, for a certain tire life, you know, setting up a car different for reds and blacks, or the hybrid setup you want in the race for both, you know, and he just had so much experience and was just, he was such an open book, and there's no doubt that he was a huge, huge attribute for me.
So we collectively went through a really dark, dark period at the end of your rookie season. Don't want this to sound cold, but you're in the sport long enough, losing people, friends dying, never stop sucking, but there does come a point to where it's less of a shock. Losing Dan at Las Vegas, I have to say, was unlike anything. And I think most people, anybody who was there in a car, in the stands, you name it, I think probably had a very same experience, same reaction to it. You're not someone who would be jumping on the phone saying, hey, there might be an opening at where he was going to go next year with Andretti. Through these sad circumstances, an opportunity does open up. How do you deal with that? How do you work through that, knowing that you're not the shark type? You're someone who does care and, you know, brings a big heart to what you do. How do you tread through that? Because I can't imagine those talks, negotiations, whatever, were completely normal, smooth. What was that experience like?
It was a weird situation. You know, I think when I got into IndyCar, I kind of naively thought that racing had gotten so safe, and, you know, we hadn't had an accident like that in a bunch of years, that it honestly just never crossed my mind. I honestly thought I would go through my career never losing a friend like that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that was just, you know, the self-preservation part of me lying to myself about it. I don't know. And so, you know, losing Dan was a huge shock. And, you know, at that point, not too long after that, you know, we've had a relatively successful first season. I figure I've done my job and the team's going to keep me and everything's going to be hunky-dory and we're going to get to go racing. And shortly after that, I lose my ride because Newman Haas closes its doors. And it was a very just weird kind of, you know, dark part of life. And I honestly hadn't even considered the option of the ride at Andretti. You know, everybody knew that he had, you know, signed the deal that day, and when Newman Haas closed their doors, we kind of just assumed that that was it, you know, that we were going to have to go find money to show up somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know, even though we had a good season, all the, like, paid rides would have been taken by December, you know, and so we were kind of thinking, all right, how are we going to, we were kind of building a strategy to go out and try and find some sponsorship. And then out of the blue, one day I get a call from JF Thorman, and he says, hey, Michael would really like to talk to you about something. And it kind of was kind of like, I got to be honest, JF, I was not expecting this phone call. It hadn't even crossed my mind. Wow. And, you know, we started talking to them. And to GoDaddy, you know, they had a big say in it as well. And I remember that I felt the need to reach out to the Weldons.
Mm.
I don't know why. It's not like I knew the family that well at that point.
But that makes sense, though.
But just something about it. It didn't seem right to not talk to them. And I knew Holly the best, Dan's sister, and so I reached out to her and explained to her that I'd been approached by Andretti about it, and we kind of chatted back and forth, and she's like, yeah, you know, we heard that you were kind of on the short list, and, you know, I've talked to the family and everybody fully endorses it. We would love it if it was you in that car. Obviously it's up to them, but if it's you, we couldn't be happier, kind of thing. And that was huge for me, that, like, it just made it more, it made it okay. I almost felt like nobody should have the car.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like the car should just stop. And then, after that conversation, I felt a lot better about it. But I also felt a huge responsibility to, you know, to Susie and to Holly and the Weldon family to do well in that car after that point.
Amen to that. So you're being summoned to go drive your Mazda RT24P. Fair. Which means we have to end this and reserve a part two, because there's way too much to do when we come back here for the race. But let's close very quickly, maybe cap this off with stepping into that GoDaddy car in 2012. I have heard rumor that there was someone else who drove it before who was a little bit popular. We had a little bit of fun at that time just referring to you as not Danica. I seem to recall you coming out for a photo op at one point with a wig on.
Uh-huh. Manica.
Yes. we would be remiss if we didn't send off part one with a little bit of fun. What was it like going through your first year as been people wanting to get the autograph of someone much smaller, much more petite, and definitely not Canadian, and with a few different chromosomal makeups?
It was great. You know, stepping into those shoes was always going to be a challenge for whoever it was going to be. You know, there is no other Danica. You know, that she and what her and GoDaddy did together was so unique and so successful that it was always going to be a challenge. And the biggest thing is that GoDaddy recognized that. They were so in tune with the fact that we were changing the game in a big way, that they wanted to embrace that and not try and make me fit into whatever mold was kind of there. Obviously, I'm not talking about the obvious. They weren't going
to
start making me wear heels and
dresses. I wanted
to see
you try and fit in her suit. Now, that would have been fun.
That would have been like the Chris Farley fat guy in a little coat thing.
Exactly.
But, you know, so they kind of let me make it my own, and together we worked on that, and it literally the ball dropped at St. Pete with coming out wearing the wig. And I loved it, man. They were such a fun company to work with. They activated better than anybody. And what was so cool about it is I inadvertently inherited the entire, 10 and under demographic, because kids just loved that car, and they loved Danica.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they just loved the green car. And so I just found myself with all these young fans, which was awesome. Because for me, for everybody, it's the most important, you know, generation, and we need to get young fans and new fans. And the big thing is I was that kid, right? I was the 10-year-old standing outside the stanchions looking for a hero card autograph. And so the fact that I had so many of those young kids that just wanted to run up and they wanted to see the green suit and the green car and get the, you know, to me that was so cool. And it was like one of the highlights of kind of getting to inherit that, you know, that role from her.
Brother, this has been a really enjoyable part one. I can't wait for part two.
Can't wait, man.
Thanks, homeboy.
And that was not Danica Patrick or Manica. Looking forward to part two. We're going to try and record this here coming up at the Rolex 24 at Daytona. You can certainly catch the latest episodes of the Marshall Pruitt Podcast on our new Facebook page, The Marshall Pruitt Podcast. You can subscribe to it as well on iTunes. And as always, I'm Marshall Pruitt. Thanks for listening.